Hello, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this podcast from ABF, the Soldiers' Charity. A gallantry special to mark Armistice Day and Remembrance Sunday on the 13th of November. Men-at-Arms, the quick march of ABF the Soldiers' Charity, especially composed by Lance Corporal James Symington of the Royal Corps of Army Music and played under his direction by the British Army Band Colchester. The Victoria Cross was introduced on the 29th of January 1856 by Queen Victoria to honour acts of valour during the Crimean War. The highest and most prestigious award of the British honour system, it is given for the most conspicuous bravery or some daring or preeminent act of valour or self-sacrifice or extreme devotion to duty in the presence of the enemy. The VC was first awarded on the 26th of June 1857, and since then the medal has been awarded 1,358 times to 1,355 individual recipients. In this gallantry special, as we mark Armistice Day, I'm joined by military expert Mark Smith from the BBC Antiques Roadshow as we turn medal detectives, uncovering the remarkable story of Captain William Leif Robinson of the Worcestershire Regiment, who volunteered for duty in the Royal Flying Corps, and the incredulous sequence of events, let alone the fortitude, great courage and sheer bloody-minded determination that earned him the Victoria Cross on the night of the 2nd of September 1916, in an aerial tale of David versus Goliath, played out in the full glare of the floodlit night skies high above London, watched by thousands on the streets below as his lone biplane took on the giant menace of a German Imperial airship Schutterlandsaerof, or SL-11. 500 feet long, 60 feet wide, the Leviathan aircraft measured twice the length of a jumbo jet and three times as wide. With a bomb payload of 21 tonnes, on that night, she formed part of the largest bombing raid Britain had ever seen, when 14 airships ventured across the English Channel, striking terror into the hearts of the nation while wreaking havoc, chaos and destruction over London and its approaches. Attack from the air by a Zeppelin was a terrifying development in warfare, which threatened our shores in a manner that had not been experienced since Napoleon's armies mustered at Calais, readying for invasion just over a century earlier. A stark reminder that the sea alone no longer guaranteed our protection. Joining us on the journey will be Falklands War veteran Mark Corrith, an experienced light aircraft pilot, to offer a latter-day aviator's insight to the challenges involved with such a daring undertaking, while historian Joshua Levine explains the context and great importance of Leif Robinson's selfless act of bravery that late summer night in 1916. But this Victoria Cross is quite unique. Not only was it the first to be awarded for an act of bravery in the United Kingdom, but one before the concept of the Royal Air Force had even begun to be considered, it is a snapshot of army history and military evolution quite of its time, and, presented just 2 days after the night engagement in question, it is also the quickest a VC has ever been awarded. In literally bursting the balloon, the 21-year-old subaltern had slayed the dragon, proved the impossible possible, his gallant action greeted with dancing and jubilation in the streets, the day proclaimed Zep Sunday, while Leif Robinson himself was transformed overnight into a dashing national hero revered throughout the land with an almost superhuman celebrity. The stage now set, our journey begins with a set of medals, just a stone's throw from Waterloo Station, where I'd arranged to meet Mark Smith under the imposing 15-inch naval guns that guard the approaches to the Imperial War Museum, home to the Lord Ashcroft Gallery, which houses the largest collection of Victoria and George Crosses in the world in a permanent display titled Extraordinary Heroes. Here we are, Margaret, in the Ashcroft Gallery up on the fifth floor of the Imperial War Museum. What are we looking at in this particular display case here?
Well, the most obvious thing is the steering wheel. And It's an incredible biscuit. It's broken, obviously. But what we're looking at is the steering wheel from SL11. There's a petrol gauge. There's photographs signed by Leif Robinson. And I suppose right in the corner, quite inconsequentially, really, are the medals, the Victoria Cross that he won.
Let's close in on Leif Robinson's medals. What do we got here?
So what we're looking at is the Victoria Cross starts it on its red ribbon. Then what is known as the 1914-15 star, the 1914-1920 British War Medal. And then on the end with the multicoloured sort of rainbow-coloured ribbon is the 1914-1919 Victory Medal. And this one has the oak leaf spray, which is a mention in dispatches.
Mark, you've got the signature for Leif Robinson's Victoria Cross. Could you read out?
Yes, of course. It says, War Office, 5th of September 1916. His Majesty the King has been graciously pleased to award the Victoria Cross to the undermentioned officer, Lieutenant William Leif Robinson, Worcestershire Regiment and Royal Flying Corps. For most conspicuous bravery, he attacked an enemy airship under circumstances of great difficulty and danger and sent it crashing to the ground as a flaming wreck. He had been in the air for more than 2 hours and had previously attacked another airship during his flight.
Let's talk about Leif Robinson himself. He was born in southern India, South Koori, on the 14th of July, 1895. And after education in England, he joined Sandhurst in August 1914 with a dream or ambition to join either the Indian or the Egyptian army. But war intervened, and in December of the same year, 1914, he was commissioned into the Worcestershire Regiment, posted to their 5th Battalion in Cornwall, where I suspect boredom probably took over, and he transferred then to the Royal Flying Corps by March of 1915, which is where the story of this clasp, this oak leaf clasp, I think, comes in.
Yes, the oak leaf will be for the actions that he undertook out in France really early on in his career. It's a gallantry award as well, so it's not something that is just lightly given. So he's obviously showing potential, you know, early on in his career.
Wounded on the 8th of May 1915 over Lille on a dawn patrol by shrapnel in the arm, he was posted back to England. He recovered from his wounds and in June 1915 starts instruction as a pilot. On 28th of July, after 230 minutes in tuition, he qualified for the Royal Aero Club certificate, gaining his wings at the Central Flying School in Uphaven on the 15th of September 1915. Soon after that, he is posted to the 19th Reserve Squadron devoted to the defence of London at a place called Sutton's Farm, which is Hornchurch in Essex, and later became RAF Hornchurch for Battle of Britain fame. But let's take the story to the 2nd of September 1916, and we'll pick it up at Hornchurch itself.
Let's go and see where he took off from.
So here we are at RAF Hornchurch. And Mark, can you just explain where we are? What is the significance of RAF Hornchurch?
Well, we're standing on what was RAF Hornchurch, which would have been known really as that during World War II. But in World War I, it was called Sutton's Farm Airfield. And this is where Leif Robinson had taken off from in his quest to try and track down these Zeppelins, airships, which had actually been tracked across, and he was getting radio messages in that they were coming towards London.
And so at approximately 2300 hours on the night of the 2nd of September, the Home Defence Squadrons were put on alert. Radio messages from the airships, as you say, had been intercepted, and a welcoming party was prepared. 10 aircraft set off that night from this airfield as part of the Home Defence Squadrons, the response to this this enormous airship attack on Britain, on London, but what was peculiar about Leif Robinson himself?
Well, that night he had taken off in something called a BE-2C fighter, so a night fighter. So the clue sort of there is in the name, that he would have taken off in the dark that night, and they would have instantly have been split up. So he would have been flying on his own. So it would have been a very lonely vigil to try and find one of these airships as they came across the coast.
And this is a single-seater biplane. And what was it armed with?
So it was armed with a 303 Lewis machine gun. That night, he was using a new ammunition, a thing called a Brock and Pomeroy. So what these were is, instead of a solid round, really they were incendiaries. So they were filled with a chemical which would either burn on the way to the target or would burn once it reached the target. So for the first time, he had a chance not only of seeing where his bullets were going, but actually being able to damage the gas envelope in such a way that it didn't just make a hole in it, but hopefully would set light to the escaping gas as well.
Let's just talk about the night itself. The fog was thick and getting worse, but Robinson was convinced it would be clearer high up. He had three drums of this special Brock and Pomeroy ammunition and just enough fuel to keep him aloft for 3.5 hours. How would he have been dressed on this fairly dangerous mission?
Well, obviously, he'd be wearing his uniform, but, you know, that's just like wearing your coat. He'd have had a leather flying jacket on and boots and big gloves and a flying helmet and goggles. But what we must remember is that he's not encumbered by a parachute, because they didn't have parachutes in that year. And not only that, but he hasn't got any oxygen. So he's got to get to really quite incredible heights through some very thin air with no oxygen support whatsoever. So he's actually, bless him, he's almost got to keep himself alive at 10 to 12,000 feet with no oxygen to keep up him.
No night visibility capability, no radar, nothing. He's flying on dead reckoning on a map, which he's doing the map reading himself. He's got no navigator, no gunner. He's a one-man flying machine with a machine gun.
That's correct, yeah.
That is a remarkable thing.
It's going to be something that would tax most of us to do. I mean, flying a small aircraft in daylight and being able to look out of the window and see landmarks that might match your map is one thing. But doing this in the dark, at such heights, in such cold, and knowing that somewhere out there is an enemy, and they can fight back.
Let's then look at SL-11, the great airship, which was not a Zeppelin, but made from plywood as opposed to aluminium of the Zeppelin design. And she was commanded by Hauptmann Wilhelm Schramm, who was an experienced airship captain, but he knew the area well because he'd grown up here. How did that come about?
His father was working here when he was a very small child. So actually he grew up in Kent. So, you know, he was very familiar with the landscape and with London itself.
So we know that Schramm approached London from the north, passing over Royston and Hitchin, but by 0100 hours on the morning of the 3rd of September, he was heavily engaged by the guns of the Dartford and Tilbury defences. Lehman and Zeppelin 98 dropped their bombs at what he took to be his London docks. Lehman then took his airship up to 13,000 feet. Suddenly, an aircraft was spotted approaching the airship. Robinson had seen the Zeppelin caught in the beam of the searchlights and had slowly climbed up to meet it. The experienced layman promptly headed for the cloud and he soon outstripped the night pilot and disappeared. Robinson no doubt cursed his luck. There's only 1.5 hours flying time left. Half an hour later, SL-11 was wreaking destruction over North London. Yeah. So Mark, tell us, what happened after he picked up SL-11 with Schramm at the helm? What happened after that?
So half an hour later, SL-11 was causing havoc over North London. Finsbury Park and the Victoria searchlights caught the aircraft just over Alexandra Palace, and the Finsbury Park gunners had opened fire. Schramm had turned his aircraft headed for Walthamstow, which is quite amazing, trying to dodge the fingers of light. Hundreds of people were watching. No matter how close the shells were bursting, the ground defences shells seemed to have no effect whatsoever. The spectators that night, however, were treated to a sight that was completely new to their experience. The crowds fell silent, and an aircraft running the gauntlet of shellfire suddenly appeared next to it.
Because this is Robinson in his little tiny wee biplane.
The airship itself is 500 feet long,
yeah.
And his aircraft has a wingspan of, you know, 25 feet, something like that. So it's a very tiny little gnat.
Huge, lumbering, great machine. And there he is. He's the David to the Goliath of the day, isn't he?
Absolutely.
What do you think he must have been thinking? He was only 20, 21 years old as he approached that great huge sight of the airship. This is the airship representing the biggest menace that Britain faced at the time. It was the presence visible of the Kaiser and Britain's enemies. And here he is, he's looking at this great thing laden with bombs. What do you think he's thinking at that time?
Do you know, probably at that moment in time, you know, he's volunteered for the Royal Flying Corps. He's volunteered to do this job. He's been out in France, he's been wounded, he's been an observer, but now he's a pilot. And I would imagine that that's his job that night, is to try and find one of these things, and if he can, shoot it down. And I would imagine that the moment that thing came up in front of him, and there it was, You can't say for certain, but I would imagine all the fear disappeared and then it was determination. Mm. I am going to get this thing.
Yeah, yeah. And don't let's forget, in April he'd had his chance for another Zeppelin and he lost it into Clara, so he was damned if he was going to lose this chance with SL-11.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm. But what the thing you've got to remember is that in the drum of bullets that he's got, whether they be these new exciting experimental rounds, he's only got three drums, so he doesn't have an awful lot of ammunition to try and bring down something which is 500 feet long.
Let's go back to that BE-2C fighter. He's got the controls, he's got the gun, and then he's got to reload the gun. Imagine if he dropped one of those drums and he'd be thinking, oh, yeah. So that takes some skill. And he's map reading at the same time.
And they're quite heavy things, those drums, with 40 rounds in there, and they're big, they're sort of frying pan sized. And what he's got to do is the gun is above him on the top wing. So when he's got to reload, he's got to bring the gun down on an arc so that he can take the old drum off, get rid of it and put the new drum on and then push it back up again. So there's quite a lot of physical effort in this, as well as flying the aircraft, as well as keeping the thing in sight and doing all of this at sort of 10,000 feet. It must have been absolutely incredible.
I mean, we made light of it, but you think oh my God, is that some kind of some man?
That is a few moments of your life that will forever be imprinted on your memory.
Yeah.
But also probably was so frenetic that it was just a blur to him.
Well, let us then think on the fact that not only is he in the attack. But this is in full searchlight. He's got to dodge the anti-aircraft fire from our own batteries, yeah. And he's in full searchlight of the searchlight teams down the ground.
Yeah, he's really got to fly the gauntlet to come up to the side of this thing. And then, as we know, what he eventually tried to do was he fired at it, and the first bursts or maybe even the first drum that he put into the thing had no effect whatsoever. So then he would have had to have, you know, banked away from it to come back round again. And then he comes up with this sort of, I suppose, notion that he can see where his rounds are going because they what we would call an incendiary round.
And so they are today, they're like modern tracer rounds. So he would have seen there had been a line of continual light going into that aircraft, into that airship, as she fired, bang, 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 all the way through.
Yeah, and what he then tries to do is he tries to concentrate all of his bullets into one specific area so that his maximum amount of firepower with these new chemical igniting bullets can get as many of them into one area as possible. And then, as we know, as eventually after three passes he then suddenly sees a glow in the actual back of the airship.
The stern of the airship.
Yeah.
She's a light.
Falklands veteran and light aircraft pilot Mark Corrith.
It is a remarkable story, a remarkable feat of aviation, and from a man who actually had such few flying hours. I mean, I've flown a good number of hours, and sometimes at night, not often. But nonetheless, when you look at the feat of flying in a B-2C, which is it is so what the Wright brothers... Pioneers of aviation, so and it's only a dozen years, if that, since aviation started, and to fly at night to 11,500, 12,000 feet, in conditions which are plainly not entirely right, and my gosh, cold, the temperature drops in a degree every couple of thousand feet that you go up, so you can end up unbelievably chilly at 12,000 feet.
You mentioned that you've been a pilot for, I don't know, 30, 40 years, but you haven't done much night flying. Presumably you choose not to night fly, so to be made to night fly after only 4 or 5 hours is even harder.
I would respect his ability enormously. I mean, when you're flying at night from a little airstrip, you've got you might have flares down to guide you, because of course they were flying from a big field as opposed to a runway. So I suspect they'd have a sort of flare to give you rough wind direction. You'd throttle forward, off you'd go. And actually, when you get airborne, you do have a horizon. It's not total pitch blackness. You do have a horizon. You actually have a surprisingly good horizon. And then the sort of lights on the fields and the farms and the villages, the towns, and even the sort of lines of where roads go and railways, and you can see quite a lot. You're not invisible. However, when you get up there and you've got clouds, you're taking your BE2C airplane up through and working your way around clouds. Have quite a feat. And I had a lovely little airplane called a Curry Watt, which is a single seat biplane. So let's say it's not hugely dissimilar in its configuration to the BE2, but you know, sitting there and you've got your wings, which are actually take away a lot of the forward visibility, and you've got the nose in front of you. So you get there's a lot of blind spots in a biplane, and I suspect I'm trying to put myself into his cockpit. You're flying up there, clouds can block out huge swathes of the sky around you. So to read when he'd lost sight of the Zeppelin and couldn't find it, I can well imagine that, and particularly as in a distance grows between him and it and hidden by clouds.
I suppose the other thing too, not having radar or anything like that, you could suddenly fly into it almost if it was in cloud, thick cloud.
I guess absolutely right. And they wouldn't have had navigation lights and all that sort of thing that we might.
I don't know what the top speed of a BE2C is, but I imagine that if you've got a Zeppelin with four Maybach engines on, I should imagine that they can put away quite significantly, I think, by comparison.
Well, a B2 would have flown at very much the same airspeed as my little Curry Watt, 70 miles an hour or so. So, you know, and I'm not sure what the Zeppelin would have been flying at, but you know, if the Zeppelin's flying at 60 miles an hour and you're flying at 70 miles an hour, you know, the closing speed is actually only 10 miles an hour. So if you're following it, you're manoeuvring. It's not an easy maneuver. A Zeppelin, of course, is a huge, long aircraft compared to
500 foot long, 60 feet wide, twice as long as a jumbo jet.
And the BE2 had a 36 foot wingspan and a 27 foot length. So it is completely different. But then I think, you know, and I was thinking through the flight, he was a young man, 21 years old. And you know, I was a soldier, and you and I were soldiers. And indeed, I ended up going to the Falkland Islands as a young officer. You know, the mindset of a young man in combat is there's a kind of strength, a denial that anything can go wrong with you, and there's an ambition. This man would have been, he had his BE2, and he would have had a huge amount of enthusiasm. He knew that Zeppelins were dropping bombs on London, and he would have had the bloodlust, the long to get up there, to engage, to take the enemy on, in the same way that I in the Falkland Islands, with my troops, were longing to get stuck in and to complete our mission. Yes, dangerous it might be, but also you get in there, you're airborne, you've got a sense of duty. You don't want to let people down. You've got an absolute enthusiasm to fulfil the mission that you know you've been given. And he had tracer type ammunition that he would probably have been longing to test out in these on this airship. I suspect the need to get stuck in would have been quite high, so the adrenaline rush would have been what would have fueled him on route. None of this, of course, takes away from the extraordinary achievement in aviation in this flight. No vectors, no radar support, no one on the ground talking to you, encouraging you on. You're just simply out there on your own, taking out a whacking great enemy. Incredible bravery. There must have been moments up in the air when you just think, crikey, what am I doing up here?
As a pilot who has great experience in small aircraft and micro aircraft, what are the challenges of flying at 11,500 feet?
Well, when you, and I've taken my little machine up to that sort of height. When you get up to that height and you've got a maximum speed of 70 odd mph, by the time you're up there, the air is thinner and you're probably going a lot slower, and the ground actually looks as if it's not moving at all. It's just sort of stationary. It's quite an extraordinary feeling. I suspect, and you can see, if the air's clear, you can see a lot. And yet you've then got these blank areas when the cloud has taken over the visibility that you thought you'd had.
As Leif Robinson is approaching the target, so to speak, he's flooded. And he's flying through his own anti-aircraft bombardment. That must not help, really.
That is brave. That is brave. Very brave. Equally, I suspect he will have seen that airship, his target ahead, and realised that he had the chance to get stuck in. I equate it to my experiences on the Falkland Islands when you were in very, very, very heavy artillery bombardment, not hugely different from anti-aircraft fire flying around you.
Not a place you want to be.
Not a place you want to be, but when you are in that sort of situation, when the adrenaline is just pumping through you, the need to get stuck into your target to engage the enemy, that I think overruns the fear. And my guess is he would have blown through that and realised that one hadn't got him, that one hadn't got him. The target's ahead, just go for it, go for it, go for it, go for it, go for it. Your focus is very tight. And I suspect he'd have thought, crikey, that didn't work, so now what should I do? So coming up below that airship, at its tail, where the sort of fins, the elevators, the rudders were, and then focusing, yeah, I can well see. Let's just focus onto that one bit of the airship and see what happens. 40-odd rounds in his magazine, not a lot. When in that those sort of situations, you just simply accept where you are and what you're doing and a determination to get the mission through and hope that you get away with it.
I mean, you're doing this in the dark. You've got a map read. You've got to keep an eye on your target. You've got to keep the aircraft steady. And yet at the same time, you're also your loader, your gunner, and your aimer.
Yeah. As a pilot of these funny little biplanes, and there's not a huge amount of stability, the air's bouncing you around at that point. He'll have had to reach down and pull that Lewis gun down along its arc, take the magazine off, and he got both hands on it. So how is he controlling the joystick? He'd be stuck between his legs and he'd be trying desperately to hold the aeroplane steady. And with the wobbles and the bounces what an extraordinary task. I've never taken a magazine off a Lewis gun, but my guess is that there's a certain amount of things to turn and twist and click. None of that is easy when you're 12,000 feet, not strapped into your aeroplane, no parachute on, an enemy Zeppelin smack in front of you. That the amount that you got to think of, the amount of mini tasks you've got to get right to achieve that aim, is quite astounding.
By road, from Sutton's Farm or RAF Hornchurch, as it later became, it's about a 45-minute drive to Cuffley. In a B-2C fighter plane, it would have been probably a 10-15-minute climb. And so we pick up the story once again at Cuffley, where SL-11 and her crew will finally founder and perish in a field behind the Plough Inn. Marked today by a roadside memorial erected by readers of the Daily Express in profound gratitude for Captain Leif Robinson's brave deed that night.
I stood by the memorial erected by readers of the Daily Express to the memory of Captain William Leif Robinson Victoria Cross, who, it says on the memorial, on September the 3rd, 1916, above this spot, brought down SL-11, the first German airship to be destroyed on British soil. Mark, let's talk through those final moments, that last drum of ammunition we spoke of.
Robinson had one drum left and precious little fuel. Now, behind and slightly below the airship, he changed tactics. He dived at the thin end of the craft, heading for the twin rubbers above and below the pair of elevators, any one of which was larger than his entire machine. His last drop of ammunition was poured into that one area. Now the guns of the ground defences were silent and all eyes were fixed on the airship, glowing in the searchlight's powerful beams. They had no idea what the pilot was doing. They knew nothing of new incendiary bullets. They did not realise that, as they watched a stream of explosive was pouring into the smallest section of the aircraft, ripping through its cotton skin. The first indication to them, to the pilot, and probably to the airship's crew themselves, that the longed-for victory was at hand was a dull pink glow from within the rear portion of the ship. Within seconds, the tail section was alight, and flames over 100 feet long shot out into the night sky. Almost in an instant, the entire hull of the airship seemed to be in flames. Thousands of cubic feet of hydrogen ignited with a brilliance which lit the sky, turning night into day. The spectators were dazzled. The searchlight was suddenly unnecessary. Observers in Reigate reported seeing the explosion. It was 2:30 in the morning on Sunday, the 3rd of September, and at 12,500 feet above London, a German airship, while in the very act of bombing the capital, had been attacked and completely destroyed.
So now Mark, you brought with us here some memorabilia from that great night. You've got hold in your hand. You're holding a photograph frame. Talk about what's in the photo frame.
Well, we got two postcards, which were, they're contemporary postcards. One, it says Zeppelin brought down in flames at Cuffley near Enfield at 2:30 a.m. Sunday, September the 3rd, 1916.
Drawn by an eyewitness.
Yeah.
You describe that the photograph we've got here. We see a.
You can see the rooftops, which are glowing from the flames from the airship as it comes down. Three searchlights.
Yeah.
Actually sort of, you know, picking it out, but you don't need it because the entire sky is just orange.
Yeah.
And that seems to be a big factor to this, that it was such a bright flame. The other postcard says, the first Zeppelin to be brought down in England, September the 3rd, 1916, 2:25. And basically, it is just a ball of orange flame.
And actually, as you see from here, you can almost see, it's like drops of the perishing aircraft just dropping down into field, which would have been directly behind us
directly
here.
Directly behind us, where these houses are.
And then the bottom of this frame, there are some twisted bits of aluminium. What was peculiar about SL-11 as opposed to the Zeppelin itself?
So SL-11 is a wooden construction airship. So the actual framework inside it was wooden, and the bags of the gas that held it in the air were between the wooden frames. But these two bits here are aluminium, and you imagine that this thing was 500 feet long.
Yeah.
And these things are sort of the size of your thumb, as smashed wreckage. So this really devastated. I mean, the crash must have been incredible to smash bits of aircraft into that size.
Yeah. Of course, this was seen from all over London.
All over London.
Which is quite remarkable.
Historian and author Joshua Levine.
Looking at the fact that he overnight became this great hero, the hero of Cuffley.
Yeah.
perhaps we should examine why that was so. Why did the public so instantly put him on a pedestal? What was the threat from the Zeppelins and the Germans in this instance?
Well, I think you've got to bear in mind that over many centuries, the British people were aware that Britain was an island, and Britain had not been invaded. And obviously, the Napoleonic era would have been the terror of invasion, but it hadn't happened. And then suddenly the advent of the aeroplane changed things in people's minds. Aeroplanes were no respecters of seas. They could move overseas. And so you had these machines of death, which were started during the First World War, appearing in the skies above Britain, miraculously, these strange cigar-shaped objects that then proceeded to drop bombs and kill people. And it was absolutely astounding. I mean, so in terms of the damage done by these bombing raids, so initially the bombing raids were carried out by Zeppelins, these airships, but airships, and then bombing was also carried out by large bombers called Gothas, slightly later in the war. But at this point, 16, it was still Zeppelins, and they did do damage. So it often surprises people to find out that, you know, some of the bomb damage in London that people are very aware of, for example, Cleopatra's Needle on the Embankment, or Lincoln's Inn, you know, large pitted buildings in Lincoln's Inn, which people assume was blitz damage from 1940-41, actually wasn't. This was damage caused by First World War bombing. This was the first blitz. And it did do damage, it did kill people. There were, you know, large scale incidents, and people started sheltering in the tubes. Years before this happened during the Second World War, London Underground became a place of shelter for citizens. But the major effect was not actually in the damage or in the deaths, it was psychological. It was this idea that the enemy could now reach our country and do more or less what it wanted to our country. So they could invade without actually having to cross the channel. And psychologically, this was a massive thing. People were terrified, genuinely terrified. You see it in the newspapers of the time. There were all the people, what can be done to stop this menace? It was like a golem. This, you could see it in the sky, but you couldn't do anything about it.
Do you think if we were to draw a parallel to today, I suppose the parallel threat would be that of drones today, but this is something far more menacing then.
I think it's more menacing in the sense that the potential for destruction was total. I mean, you know, you had H.G. Wells writing about, you know, his pre-First World War book about the destruction of New York. But in people's minds, this heralded the end of civilization. And, you know, it's easy to laugh about that, well, say laugh or to dismiss it. But, I mean, you know, not many years later, look what happened in the latter part of the Second World War with, you know, the attacks on German cities in Tokyo and the atomic bombs. It was a very, very real fear. I mean, it was a fear that actually rose up again before the Second World War, before the Blitz. People felt that, you know, there would be millions of deaths within days of the start of the Blitz. But certainly during the First World War, people didn't know what was coming. They just knew that it could be cataclysmic. So this idea of the airships, of the Zeppelins, the Schutterlanzers, you know, here was a real golem, and something has to be done. And then you have this young man, William Leaf Robinson, from a pretty ordinary background, who was a member of the Royal Flying Corps, knew how to fly, but suddenly he was the person who shot that Schutterlanze, that airship, out of the sky, and the country went mad. I mean, the reaction of, you know, initially, Leif Robinson's colleagues in the Royal Flying Corps, who were delighted for him, but it grew and it grew and it grew. I've got a letter here that Leif Robinson wrote in the immediate aftermath.
Yeah.
Because what happened to him was astonishing. I mean, he was awarded the Victoria Cross,
the fastest ever award ever made. 2 days.
And what it reflected, I mean, it's certainly his act was a, you know, a very brave act. He flew up to where this airship was flying three times. He made three distinct attacks, and he did shoot it down, the first ever to be shot down, because he had incendiary ammunition. You know, it suddenly was much easier to shoot these things down because he had tracer bullets. So that, in effect, is how he immediately became this hero. And if you read, I mean, there is this letter that in the aftermath he wrote to his parents. And he says, I want to say a lot about the strafing of L-21, but I can't because it's most strictly secret. And because I'm so tired of the subject and telling people about it. So everyone wanted to hear. And he says in the aftermath, he says, thousands, one might say millions of throats were giving vent to thousands of feelings. He writes, I would give anything for you, dear people, to have heard it. A moment before, dead silence, for the guns had ceased to fire at it. Then this outburst, the relief, the thanks, the gratitude of millions of people, all the sirens, hooters and whistles of steam engines, boats on the river, and munition and other works all joined in and literally filled the air. And the cause of it all? Little me, sitting in my little aeroplane above 13,000 feet of darkness. It's wonderful.
He had, I think, 5 offers to have his portrait painted for the Royal Academy.
That, this is the end of the letter. 5 artists offered to paint his portrait. He says, I dare say you've seen in the papers, babies, flowers, and hats have been named after me. Also, poems and prose have been dedicated to me. Oh, it's too much. I'm recognized wherever I go about town, whether in uniform or mufti. The city police salute me. The waiters, hall porters, and pages of hotels and restaurants bow and scrape. Visitors turn round and stare. Oh, it's too thick. This is a young, it's still a boy, really. And, you know, he doesn't come from the age of celebrity. He comes from an age before people are suddenly, you know, hoist into public consciousness on television. It's extraordinary.
People had his photograph in their sitting room.
Yeah. I found a wonderful in the RAF museum a little girl's diary. And his face is posted in, she's probably a 14, 15-year-old girl, and the front page is a photograph of Leif Robinson. He is her hero. He's her pop idol. I think so. I mean, and you're looking at an era as well where the aeroplane's absolutely new. I mean, he's flying in 1916. The aeroplane was first flown at the end of 1903. So he's doing something that very, very few people have done. And people don't even understand how it works. It's a, you know, at the beginning of the First World War, when the Royal Flying Corps flew down, you know, they were based up in Scotland at Montrose, and they had to fly down through England before they flew across to France. And everywhere they stopped, people would just stare at these extraordinary flying machines. What were they? And they were odd. I mean, they were made of wood and canvas, and they were light, and they had unreliable engines. They really couldn't be relied upon. I mean, before they flew across to France, they had to get up to like 4,000 or 5,000 feet, simply because the engines were expected to fail, and they had to be high enough that they could just drift across if they did. So he's doing something totally new, totally terrifying anyway, and now he's gone up to face this monster. So it's an astonishing.
We're now going to go on to the final stage in this story, which is the cemetery at Harrow Weald. Here we are now in the southern extension of the Harrow Weald Cemetery at All Saints Church, Harrow Weald, and we are looking at the sorry state of Captain William Leif Robinson, Victoria Cross's grave. And this is where the story comes full circle. This brave young man who pitted himself against the might of the German armed forces in the sky and took on single-handedly and very bravely a Zeppelin or SL-11 and brought it down to the great
the great to public acclaim. He returned to service on the Western Front and was shot down on his first mission flying the new Bristol aircraft
in an action led by the Red Baron,
and ended up being held in prison. And while he was in prison, I think it's fair to say he was set upon. He was a great escapist, but he was seen to be, you know, the German army did their best to break him. He returned in 1918 after the armistice back to Harrow, and of course, at the end of the First World War, we forget that the Spanish flu broke out. Mark, tell us about the Spanish flu.
Well, it was a bit like the pandemic, really, that we've just gone through before, but a really, really deadly strain. And one of the problems was that the people that it was going to affect weren't fit and healthy before it started. They were people who had fought for 4 odd years in the trenches, and they were already, you know, physically debilitated. And when this disease came along, it ravaged them. And it brought them down in their millions and killed millions of people. And people like Leif, who had fought for many months, you know, under the stresses of combat and then been a prisoner of war, their bodies just couldn't take it. And that really was such an unfair and cruel extra that happened at the end of the Great War, just to take away even more people than the actual war did itself.
It's written here that in his less than healthy state, Robinson succumbed to the infection on Tuesday the 31st of December 1918. His condition quickly deteriorated. During the delirium which preceded his last moments, Captain Robinson was haunted by the vision of the arch brute. He imagined that Niemeyer, the man, the commandant of the prisoner of war camp, who subjected him to great privation, and the sentries with fixed bayonets were standing by his deathbed. Several times he called out to be protected. His sister Kitty, fiancée Joan, nursed him as best they could, but he no longer had the strength to fight his illness. He died late that night on the 31st of December 1918 from cardiac failure. He was just 23 years old. England mourned the passing of one of the war's most popular heroes, and hundreds attended the funeral, which took place at Harrow Weald on Friday the 3rd of January 1919. The procession set out from Lavender Cottage, the house where William had spent his last days. A flight of aircraft led by Brigadier Huggins, the commander of the South East Home Defence Squadrons during 1916, flew overhead, and a large wreath was dropped before the house. It was placed, along with some of the hundreds of other tributes, on the coffin. The procession made its way up the Archbishop's Road to the tiny Harrow Weald Cemetery by All Saints Church. The central band of the Royal Air Force, the coffin borne on an Air Force trailer, officers of the Home Defence Squadrons, contingents of men from Hounslow and Northolt, and the lines of silent mourners. The muffled bells of All Saints rang out 720 Grand Sire doubles, and Sergeant Major Murrell, Chief RF Trumpeter, sounded the last post. Mark, I know you have something to read.
Nor law nor duty bade me fight, nor public men nor cheering crowds. A lonely impulse of delight drove to this tumult in the clouds. I balanced all, I brought all to mind. The years to come seemed waste of breath, a waste of breath the years behind, in balance with this life, this death.
And here ends the story of one of our greatest and bravest sons, Captain William Leif Robinson, Victoria Cross, Royal Flying Corps, late the Worcester Regiment. A very brave man.
Leif Robinson earned his Victoria Cross, was not, you know, was partly in, you know, flying up and immensely courageously encountering this huge, great, terrifying machine that terrified the entire nation. But actually what he got it for was the act which completely transformed the nation, because people were terrified. They really didn't know what was coming. They thought it heralded the end of the country, the end of civilization. And at a stroke, he shot it down and he ended that terror. He made people realize across the country that these machines were not invincible. They were not going to herald the end of everything. He did that. He himself, in that moment, lifted the morale of the nation like nobody had up till that point. That's what he should be remembered for basically salvaging the morale of the nation in one shot.
And so our journey ended in the forlorn anonymity of a forgotten weed-choked corner of a graveyard in North London. A scene which felt wholly at odds for being who in life was so fated for his brave deeds. As he drove back, we agreed that it almost would have been kinder if William Leaf Robinson had been killed in action than suffer the ignominy of his resting place today. He and his kin, other brave servicemen and women, deserve better than some unloved, untended, and unkempt plot of grey suburbia. A national cemetery where our heroes and heroines can rest at peace in quiet dignity. Their noble endeavours a reminder of duty done and a shining example for we who follow in their shadow. I'm reminded of the speech by that towering figure of ancient Greece, the great soldier-statesman Pericles, in his celebrated funeral oration from the Peloponnesian War. Words which are as applicable today as they were when written in the 5th century BC. "For the Athens that I have celebrated," he said, "is only what the heroism of these and their like have made her." Nearly 80 years on, the central purpose of ABF, the Soldiers' Charity, remains the same: safeguarding our soldiers, veterans, and their immediate families so they can live a life of independence and dignity for the service they have given and still give to their country, and guaranteeing our freedom and liberty. It is the debt we owe them yesterday, today, and tomorrow. With my thanks to Mark Smith, Mark Corrith, and Joshua Levine for their part in making this programme, Stephen Connolly of Court Jurors, Cleveland Company, David Erskine Hill and the Lord Ashcroft Medal Collection, Roger Cole and Kirsty Toth, the Imperial War Museum, for permission to record in the Lord Ashcroft Gallery at the Imperial War Museum. Mark Smith read an excerpt from An Irish Airman for Caesar's Death by W.B. Yeats. Nidamus Tay was sung by the National Youth Choir of Great Britain under the musical direction of Michael Brewer, with London Symphony Orchestra conducted by the music's composer, Carl Jenkins. If you enjoy this podcast, write to learn more about the work of ABF, the Soldiers' Charity, and how we support soldiers, veterans and their families, please visit soldierscharity.org. Programme editors were Jenny Redman and Neil Kernahan, with studio editing by Steve Campen at Creative Radio. This has been a GamePro production for ABF, the Soldiers' Charity.